Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. It's been a few weeks here. The holidays coincided with the show, so I had a few weeks off. Nice little break. Embracing 2015 and all of its already insane and confusing, overwhelming character. And as I face the total confusion of our world, which I often experience as just kind of overwhelmingly weird and disorienting, frustrating, I once again fall back on how to make my way through this this maelstrom, how to make choices, how to decide what I'm going to do, who I'm going to talk to. And I realize, especially as the older I get, that I increasingly find my way through connections, not so much the expanding social networks of light contacts that seem to dominate social life today, but rather through a kind of subtler and sometimes odder resonance with particular individuals who, even though I may not see very often or talk to as frequently as I would like, just knowing that they're sort of in the web helps me sort of not so much focus as kind of resonate at the right frequencies. And our guest today, Juris On, I know him as Dr. Concrescence, and so I always call him Dr. Con, but Juris is his quote-unquote real name. It's one of these characters, one of these nodes in the network, and he's done a lot of interesting things, and we'll be talking about that, one of these dwellers of on the thresholds and in the margins. But one of the characteristics he has is that he occasionally writes poetry, and I was just picking through his book, The Heaping Up of Small Things, which came out, I don't know, maybe 2009, and I thought I'd just read a poem. This is called Possessed, and it's a good term because we will be talking a little bit about hoodoo and voodoo this hour. Possessed, not a failed experiment, rather a chance to redefine the parameters, to take account of clonisms and other signs of garden variety possession. That cup of free coffee from Pete's is causing a spontaneous pulsating sense of meaning in the fractured gestalt of my worldview. I know they are simply civic employees, not Ogun's minions, digging a hole to bury my faults beneath sewer and street. But what am I to make of the burly man's man who, ignoring the opportunity to whistle at post-urban casual sweat, in fact, is overheard saying, "I know he was possessed by demons and all that, but he had some good ideas." Is it simple ownership by beans harvested somewhere without the simulated movie veneer feeding my neurology jungle nutrients and Gaian blood? Or is it more? A simple coincidence, having no sense beyond the rough chance of occupying my thoughts and peptides with contemplations of ethics and motives and aesthetic principles, roughly configuring our random encounter this day with these words, answering the question you forgot to ask. I love that poem because it captures the peculiarity of synchronicities, or those overheard resonating fragments that intrude upon our lives, often with a kind of equal mixture of ominous potential meanings and a kind of gleeful absurdity. And again, though it's not a place one wants to plant one's permanent flag, as that way lies madness. Nonetheless, it continues to sort of haunt the edges of the mindscape, this sense of possible resonances, of strange coincidences, of synchronicities that point to deeper orders of power and sometimes deeper orders of confusion and contradiction that we often ignore as we make our way through our day-to-day lives with these fictions and facts we take for masks of ourselves. So I look forward to our conversation with Dr. Con today. It's going to be a bit freewheeling, I suspect. as the man himself is. But before we bring him onto the show, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou, the White Witch of Los Angeles. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
So, yeah, we haven't spoken for weeks, man. How was your how were your holidays?
So
what was a high point, a peak?
Oh, geez, Louise. I had a pretty good holiday. The high point, I did the spiritual thing where you don't sleep and you don't eat for 4 days. It's like a fast at the solstice. That's part of Native American tradition that my teacher, Dr. DeWolf, did. So I was on this 4-day sleep fast with no food, and my little sister and I took our kids to Disneyland as a surprise for Christmas. So I went to Disneyland on 2 nights, no sleep. I was halfway in, and we got like the hotel there and everything because we wanted to have the whole experience. So it really was a positively psychedelic experience going to Disneyland under those circumstances. And our kids were like freaking out because it was a surprise, so they didn't know. So it was like really a very special experience.
My God, that sounds amazing.
It was really amazing.
I love Disneyland. I'm one of those, you know, I'm from Southern California, and so I grew up with it as a sort of magic land. And when I was about, I think about 8 years old, a friend of mine, his father worked for General Dynamics, you know, huge aerospace, you know, evil aerospace company. And they for a party, they like rented out Disneyland. Like it's that kind of corporation. So we got to go one night where there was like, just like, there was nobody. So it was like going to heaven. It was like the most like was my first experience of like totally gratified desire. Cause you just like, you could just go, you didn't have to wait in line. There it is. And it was incredibly surreal. And so I haven't been for years, but that sounds like a marvelous way to align the solstice energies.
Yes. It was very amplified.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we're going to spill our way through this hour of conversation with Urus. Welcome to Expanding Mind, man.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good.
That intro was kind of mind blowing because it has everything to do with like my today's circumstance.
Oh, I could not,
what happened today?
I could not sleep last night, and on the East Coast, pizza's kind of hard to come by, so I was just swigging a cup of bulletproof coffee and getting some slight tremor from sleep deprivation. And you read the poem about the clonisms, about drinking so much caffeine to keep going that it sort of cracks everything open. And then similarly, I've only been to Walt Disney Land once with my daughter, who doesn't live with me, and I'd gone down to Southern California. Her mom and her husband had gone to Comic-Con to shill a comic that they'd written. So I went down and picked up my daughter, who I believe was 9 years old at the time. And for whatever reason, my brother went with me. The hotel we were staying at was way off the beaten track, but it was overloaded with Comic-Con people. So it was impossible to find like anybody to help. And the motion sensors in the room had reversed themselves. So whenever we stopped moving, the lights would turn on. And we didn't sleep for the day before because we were just so excited to see my daughter. And then that night, we couldn't actually fall asleep. We kept yelling at each other from each other's bed, thinking the other person was turning on the lights. So neither of us got any sleep. And so my first experience of Walt Disney World, land rather than world, was 2.5 days of no sleep with my daughter. It was a truly psychedelic experience.
Amazing.
Well, that's marvelous. Everything's already resonating. I wanted to mention to people that you know, I've known you for quite a long time, but one of my kind of fondest memories of times we've spent together is when there was a period where I was availing myself to the isolation tank that you had in your basement bathroom. And it was a really marvelous experience because you just sort of, you know, you had a kind of setup so I could come by and just sort of use it. And then always afterwards, there was sort of the weird kind kind of come down where we would just sit and talk amidst all of the marvelous plants that you had in the backyard there in San Francisco before you moved to the East Coast. And I know that you had to give up the isolation tank, but I feel like we might as well just start there.
Oh yeah.
How and why did you wind up with an isolation tank in your basement bathroom?
That's a good question.
The bathroom, that entire room was built for that tank, and I've been working due to my obsessive interest in consciousness hacking, as the kids are calling it today. had gotten involved with Tools for Exploration, which you mentioned actually in Technosis years ago, which was a catalog that sold over 1,000 different tools for consciousness exploration. And they went from the subtle to the high tech, to the sensory deprivation tank, to the $10,000 orgone accumulating rare earth metal magnet and noble gas devices. And during that period of time, I'd had one chance to use a tank before Michael Hutchinson's. He had a mind gym briefly in San Francisco in 1988-89. And I joined that and I tried the tank, but it wasn't the flotation experience wasn't that good because there was too much vibration. And so during my period of time at Tools, I got exposed to a lot of people, hence my interest in neurofeedback and a lot of different disciplines. And at one point, I went to someone's house in Petaluma, and he had a very similar setup to mine, except he literally had just given one of the spare bedrooms over to the tank. And you had to kind of walk naked down the major hall to go into the sort of house bathroom to jump in your shower. And he heard I'd floated before, so he decided, myself and someone else had gone, he had decided to leave me in for about 2 hours. And when I came out, it was one of the most profound, non-drug-induced, non-dual experiences I'd had up to that point. I was still smoking in those days, and I remember walking out to have a cigarette. And there was one rotting rose hanging off of the porch there, and I looked at that rose and it was so intensely beautiful that I just started weeping uncontrollably for like 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's a great story. Reminds me of I think I did it at your house maybe, I don't know, a dozen times, 10 times, something like that. And it was always very interesting, but I would rarely like leave with that kind of experience. You know, it was right. Just, you know, I was sort of relaxed, or I kind of like I woke up from a nap or something. I would never sleep in the tank. I was always awake. But then there was just one time. And it was so subtle, I can't even really describe it. It's like everything was totally normal. And this is why it kind of reminds me of that non-dual state. Everything was just, I was watching, you know, taking a shower and putting on the clothes up. We were going to go upstairs and probably smoke a cigarette. But there was sort of like another space, or there was space inside the experience. And it was as if I kept expecting it to go away, but it didn't go away. It lasted for... Well, certainly through the rest of the day. I mean, it's a really remarkable experience, the tank. I mean, one of the things that – and we've had somebody else on the show, Twig Harper, who also is into the tank, is that one of the things that strikes me about it, and I'm curious about your reaction, is that the space that I've gotten into – not that I've gone that deeply with it, but the space that I've gotten into isn't like anything else. It's not like meditation. It's not like napping. It's not like astral projection. It's not like being high. It's not like – you know, daydreaming. It's something else. And it's a very, and just the fact alone that you can use a tool and go somewhere else, somewhere new, somewhere different that doesn't really have any very good maps for it. That's just, you know, really fascinating to me.
Oh, I agree. And that's why I became obsessed enough with the tank to actually buy one and try, you know, basically sort of rent it out to people or just let people float in there. And that's one of the tools in terms of consciousness hacking that I think is well underused, underlooked, but You know, it's a curious
Well,
thing.
Let's talk about that. I want to push on this because you mentioned the phrase conscious hacking. We've had, you know, Mikey Spiegel on the show. We've talked. It's, you know, it's clearly there's a movement now of, you know, mostly younger people who are interested in hacking, life hacking, but they're realizing you can hack consciousness. You can bring some of that, you know, tweaky engineering, app driven, you know, nouveau transhumanism to bear on consciousness. And it's very, if you're, you know, being older like us, you look at that and you go, oh, this is totally cool. But it's also like, this is not new, kids. There's a whole current here. There's a whole tradition here, which, and I'm the jury's out for me on how much of that older tradition is really being recognized and grappled with by a lot of the people who are interested in the topic of consciousness hacking now. Mm-hmm. It's a big field, so I can't pretend to generalize. But I am interested, since I know you've checked out some of these scenes, and what your reactions are, and also what you feel like is the most important either tools or experiences or reactions or thoughts that you have based on all the years you've done with a lot of different technologies and doing them in a way that's both, you know, skeptical but also open-minded. You're not a new ager who's just like wanting to get high. It's like you're really interested in how these things, you know, change the self and change your view of the world. So you've got a rich realm of experience there to draw off of. And so I'm interested in hearing what you would like to remind people today or bring forward today, like the tank, as something that's underutilized, that we should be paying more attention to as we plunge into, you know, ever more refined techno social ways of tweaking consciousness.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. And there is a certain aspect, like, you know, I'm far more deeply embedded than you are in this tech sphere. I mean, I walk around with my smartphone. I use it in inappropriate situations. It's really become an extension of me. I played, you know, in these fields. I've been sort of like in a way, sort of backing away after being an IT consultant for years and years. I'm sort of backing away from all this stuff. There's a part of me that wants to get back into it. And so... One of the things, this glorification of technology, this technium uber alles that's happening here, has blocked out in a lot of ways some very simple direct tools. I'm working currently on something I was calling niche, or non-instrumentalized consciousness hacking and exploration. But what I mean by that is bringing back this whole Robert Anton Wilson, Christopher Hyatt, maybe logic, experimental approach to living. Because there's a lot of these, part of the fetishizing of technology is that the technology becomes the thing itself. It's kind of like, you know, you can join 1,000 different, you know, progressive organizations that will have you sign 1,000 different petitions, but it's not like getting on the street, getting into someone's face, writing articles and doing real activity. It becomes a substitution for the activity. And what's happening a lot, at least the way that I'm seeing it in the sort of consciousness hacking thing, is that we're stepping into the fetishization of the technology itself and losing sight of the fact that all this is very old. It has been going on for a very, very long time, and that you don't need something that, you know, necessarily beeps and, you know, cracks and produces fine lights.
It's pretty hysterical, actually, because it's like a consciousness hack of consciousness hacking. Whoever is developing these technologies to fool the consciousness hackers that they need something else is like the supreme consciousness hacker ever, because they're tricking the people who think they're tricking the system.
Exactly. And, you know, it's all sort of meshed up in terms of the forgetting, right? I mean, I did clinical neurofeedback. I worked with kids with autism. I worked with adults with brain injuries, a lot of ADD, ADHD, all that kind of stuff. Those protocols, those things we tried, and all of that is being sort of pushed aside. And I used to say that the reason they were trying to medicalize it, besides they could bill a lot more money, was that they were trying to keep it out of the hands of everybody else. Because I'm like, I can teach a kindergartner how to do neurofeedback. It's really not that hard. But what's happened is all that stuff has sort of drifted away, and it's become part of this priest class. Now, like, you know, the Muse, it's a great little device, but there was a Baffler article about the Muse, and I'm like, yeah, here's the problem. Like, you're giving people this very powerful, potentially powerful feedback tool, but you don't explain to them how it actually works. You don't let them try their own things. You don't say how this affects this. What you do is you give them a prepackaged thing and say, this is going to work, and basically, you know, they're ignorant of how it works. So to me, that, yeah.
No, yeah. Let's stay with this a moment. I want to unpack what you said, because you said a lot of important things, and I just want to make sure everyone's kind of up to speed. So let's just talk about neurofeedback and the idea of neurofeedback and where it comes from, and just the fact that it doesn't necessarily imply technology. I mean, people hear that word, they hear biofeedback, neurofeedback. The word feedback, you know, people think about machines or whatever, and obviously machines are useful in the process, but there's a more fundamental principle that I think is precisely what needs to be articulated, that you're saying is kind of covered over by the new sort of technological fetishization of these things. So what is neurofeedback? Talk a little bit about it and your experience of it and how you've worked with people with it.
So since the 50s, well, before that, neurofeedback came up, I think, in the 1940s. But since the 50s, the Greens and a lot of other people have done research where you can detect on the scalp, you can detect a small electrical charge. And by measuring that charge, very quickly you can learn how to control that charge. And so we've gone through this period of time where people did brain mapping, and they would do a map, a QEG, quantitative EEG, of an entire brain. And someone who was highly focused would have one map, and someone who had ADHD would have another map. And so the approach for a long time with neurofeedback was that you were training people to become the other ideal state. But previous to that, there was a lot of stuff like alpha theta training. There's a lot of alpha and a lot of theta that comes out in relaxation and meditation. Alpha is more of a sort of a waiting zone, and theta is deep meditation, deep relaxation, and deep dreams as well. So one of the reasons the tank is so effective is that it very deeply launches you into theta waves. So neurofeedback is one way that you can actually feed back that information in various modalities. There's all kinds of different ways of doing it, so that you can learn to change that electrical activity. And one of the things that still blows my mind, even though I've heard some semi-rational explanations, is one of the first tests they did with neurofeedback is they actually took two electrodes in one nerve in someone's arm. It wasn't a nerve that was connected to any muscle or anything else. It was just an isolated nerve. And they put the electrode on either side and measured its potential. And whenever it fired, it would produce a click. So the people that they tried this on very quickly learned how to produce clicks in whatever way that they wanted to do. But this is crazy, because it's not like they had to move a muscle. It's not something that is normally considered to be under voluntary control. But by providing that one tiny bit of feedback, you can learn how to control an entirely unique thing. And so that's where neurofeedback and biofeedback in general became so exciting, because you by exposing other parts that are normally unconscious to consciousness, your consciousness can interact with it and begin to change it for other things. So, you know, there was a lot of people who treated ADD, ADHD, a lot of controversy about the science, and a lot of back and forth between the neurofeedback clinicians, doctors, scientists, people who said there wasn't enough double blinds and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, all of that, I mean, this is what I call the corporate scientist world, because there's science and then there's a science that's being paid for by someone. It's also it's interesting to me that suddenly, like, all this debate is sort of disappearing as we're releasing more and more consumer goods that involve, like, direct neurofeedback that are claiming various things. But as far as I know, no new studies have been done. So everything is still in the sort of chaotic mess that it was always in, except now, since it can be monetized and people are going to make lots of money in it, and there's going to be shareholders, suddenly people aren't looking so hard at the actual science.
Now, sure, just explain what the Muse is and how it's being marketed, because it's a very interesting kind of event as a marketed piece of biofeedback.
So what the Muse is it's a three-site. I've only ever seen one. I haven't actually tried it on. But it's a three-site EEG machine that's all-inclusive. You put it in, and it causes negative feedback. So what happens is, It measures for what is associated as relaxed brain waves, primarily alpha. And whenever you drift off of alpha, it produces the sound of a storm. And so by learning to quiet the storm, you're learning how to control your own brain. So it's being marketed as a way to de-stress for executives or other stressed out people. It's a fascinating, fascinating toy. And, once again, I kind of like to open it up and, the open BCIM people, the people who've done the big Kickstarter where it could be a neurofeedback device. It could be an EKG device. It's basically electrodes, the very sensitive electrodes that can do all the stuff. Those people are opening it up. But once again, there's no one so far who's stepping forward and saying, hey, these are all the cool things that have been tried. Now start with this and let's play.
I can see. It's funny. It's sort of like a little encapsulation of so many larger issues involving, technology, innovation, market devices, consumerism, ideas of the self. They're all like bound up with this one thing. And one of the things that interested me about the Muse, if people haven't been exposed to it, just go, do a web search and look at the ads, is that the ads and the way that the device is sort of integrated into the body is normalizing something that in the 1980s that only sort of weirdos and new agers and scientists were interested in. Like an average person going along and go, oh yeah, I think I'm going to put this weird device on my head to control my brain waves. I mean, A, it just sounded crazy, and B, even if you understood the science of it, it sounded just weird and kind of nerdy. So the only people who were going to do it outside of research scientists who were interested in, tracking, issues of epilepsy or ADHD or whatever, were, new agers, consciousness hackers, like tweaky people on the edge who were interested in that. And now you like look at it and you go, wow, actually we are now at a place where the idea of just putting some technology around and measuring and to some degree stimulating or, looping through the brain, that's part of the world we're in now. And so that's kind of cool, but at the same time, it comes with that basic problem that exists throughout digital technology, which is that in order to make things more accessible, more appropriate for a consumer market, you have to hide the tech. You have to hide the openness of the code. You have to hide all these things in order to make them plug and play. And of course, there's always people who are trying to, keep those doors open. And a lot of the conscious hackers are all about that, about keeping that open and about keeping the possibilities open. But it's this weird kind of race between the plug and play and the kind of wild, crazy open world. And it's very confusing.
Well, and a lot of it has to do with who controls the platform, who gets to monetize all your personal information, who gets to do all this stuff. Because, so that's one of the reasons I'm getting much more interested. One of the most profound experiences I ever had was doing Big Mind. I mean, outside of doing voodoo or trance ceremony or drugs. But it's such a simple technique, but when it's done by someone who knows exactly what they're doing, whether it's voice dialogue my version of it, Trance Dialogue, which is much more voodoo-oriented, or Big Mind. You can go into a very, very deeply profound non-dual experience and have that one taste. And there is no technology involved other than communication in words. And so, but the thing is, yeah, you know, Genpo Roshi is trying to monetize it, and he should. I mean, it's good that he gets to sort of, you know, support himself doing that and all that, but it's not really monetizable. You can't have a patent on Big Mind. And I mean, and as I like to say when I do Trance Dialogue, you know, I mean, he just, the Stones, who, Helen Sidis Stone, who developed it in the first place, they just rediscovered ancient voodoo practices. They learned how to build, pull up an archetype to the point that it actually takes over you when you go into a transitory state. So it's kind of hard to say, oh, this is copyrighted or copyrightable. So, yeah, so we're in this interesting thing, because there's a lot of shell games. I mean, a lot of our modern culture is one giant con game. And it seems to be, you know, besides, one of the things that's disturbing me the most recently is the sort of people's inability to think outside of black and white terms and to stop and to think in terms of maybe logic, or say, yes, this is true, but this is also true. Like everybody in here, I'm doing it myself, but people seem to be more and more falling into these polarities. And I think it's because this sort of platform of our culture has become so digitized that we've lost complete control of the narrative. And it might not be that, yeah, you can now create pictures or do your neurofeedback to feel calm after you spent a day, selling overpriced gas to people who can't afford it. You know, but even the base of the narrative is no longer ours. It's very much like Facebook. Facebook, you know, you don't own anything on Facebook. And you can only do certain things on Facebook. And I mean, I'm obsessed with Google and Google Awesome and Google. I'm playing that silly game Ingress where I'm convinced I'm mapping portals for the NSA. I don't know, but that's a whole different story. but if you want to have your mind blown, look up this game Ingress, INGRESS. You can only play it with your smartphone. And there's two teams who are basically competing for portals, and it's real-world mapped, but these portals are mapped onto educational statues or objects, or like parks or libraries, and it all has to be walked to. So one of the thrills about it is you actually have to go out into the world and walk around and interact with things. But then you're either, you know, it's alien energy, and you're either the Enlightenment, like I am, which is meaning we're using the energy to become a better human race, or it's the rebellion who's trying to get rid of all the alien energy. So this is the story, but it's all by Google, and I'm sure the NSA is using it for the deep data miners are using it for their own nefarious purposes. But it's fun. I get sucked into this.
But it's fun. I love it. Well, listen, we got to take a break right now. I want to talk more about voodoo and trance and other things you're up to, but we got to hear some messages. So you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maju Dau, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maju Dau. I'm here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Dr. Con Crescent today about hacking your consciousness. And before the break, we are talking a little bit about some of the specific techniques. You did name like one good technique that you don't really need anything for. But it's kind of interesting, like if you zoom out from the big picture of all these conceptual consciousness hacking technologies and techniques, whether you need a device or you don't need a device, what I always kind of look at it, it's like mechanics or surgeons, and everyone's getting like more and more specialized on this one little thing, right? Like you'll take some kind of consciousness hack, and that can somehow focus in on some particular issue or thing. And if you zoom out far enough, you can see how, like, every spiritual thing is like that, right? Each religion has its own little specialization where it's going to treat this, will treat your sins, yoga will treat your muscles, right? Like, everybody's getting into all of these complexities. But I wonder if in your research and looking at this, have you seen or been able to discern a kind of underlying pattern? I mean, obviously we can trace them back to ancient techniques, but even within those, do you find like a main aggregation point? They all kind of hover back around, or does it just kind of go out like spaghetti noodles?
Well, I think it goes out like spaghetti noodles. And but that doesn't mean that there isn't coherence. One of the things that I mentioned to Eric when we're exchanging some emails that I've become more obsessed with over the last few years is what I'm calling the long conversation. And the long conversation, when I explained it to someone, that they knew exactly what I meant, and I was shocked. It's that point in, let's say, any kind of mystical experiences, let's say a heavy psychedelic experience, where you hear or say something and you realize that you've been participating in this conversation since before you were born, and it's going to keep on going long after you're dead. And over the period of my life, in various circumstances, I've seen various aspects of what I'm calling the long conversation at the moment, that in these various techniques, you get like, you know, like a little half of a word. And then 10 years later, you're doing something completely else, and you suddenly drop in and hear the other half of that word.
Right.
That's not exactly it, but that's the best way that I can sort of, you know, put words on it, as it were. And so in my experience and in my life, I definitely think that there is some sort of concrescent whole. I mean, so, you know, so, yeah, so concrescence came from Alfred North Whitehead, who used it, instead of using it to parts coming together to create a whole, he used it to mean God coming into this world.
Right.
And I definitely think there is this parts that come together to make some sort of whole. What that thing is, I'm not 100% sure, but it's, hey, it's a great obsession, and it's a fun thing to go exploring.
Well, and, pardon me, I feel like when you do watch those long conversations, they all kind of go back to the same underlying theme. Like, for everyone I've talked to that's experienced a long conversation, it usually will have some relationship to the golden mean or the golden ratio or something like along those lines, where it is about meeting in the middle or having a point that comes together in the center, like between heaven and earth somehow. And you can see that long conversation in every
right.
religion, in every like hack, in everything. It seems to be some kind of thing about bringing two converging points into a center, or, you know, however many from the two it goes into, right, every single number you can think of for infinity.
Right.
But there seems to be that, what you just said, that bringing the heaven to a meeting point or something, right? Does that theme
right.
tend to, like, be similar for your long conversations?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I mean, you know, some parts of mine are completely and utterly wackadoodle, and I know they're mine. You know, I've had experiences of seeing Yahweh's space fleet and being picked up by, like, one of the trailer daemons who took me out into the galactic space. And when I got there, they told me some things, and then 5 years later, I heard that exact conversation coming out of someone else's mouth at a restaurant. And,
totally.
You know, so that, you know, whatever the fireworks are, the point is that, yes, I still am getting that, seems to be the general feeling from whatever this thing is. And all these ways, I think, are ways into it. You know, we're talking a little bit about voodoo, and the metaphor for voodoo is that, you know, you have a particular saint, or with the Orisha anyhow, it's true for the Loa as well, but you have a particular saint, and you take on that saint, or rather the saint chooses you, and it's really a sort of a method of self-exploration. But there is a point that I all see it as an inverted funnel. Like you come up with this like concrete thing, like Ogun or Eshu or one of these spirits, and you start off there, and you're like, oh, that's this concrete thing that's out there. Then it just turns into like everything. It eventually becomes everything. It becomes the spaghetti monster out there.
Right.
It's just like you can't tell them apart anymore. You know that you started in this one place, but it just turned into everything. And then eventually we, you know, the mountain is just the mountain again, right?
Right. It seems like for a lot of, even if you go back to biofeedback or voodoo or any kind of the consciousness hacking techniques, it's interesting that people focus on the getting there instead of the thing they're getting to. It almost seems like after all this time and everyone's experience, like going back to Erica, no one's like paying attention to the history of these things anymore. And everyone's just like plucking these weird ancient techniques. It's like they've lost the reason that they're doing it, so they don't even know like why, and then everyone keeps like accidentally finding this long conversation, and it's so frustrating because
right.
It feels like everyone just keeps finding this long conversation accidentally over and over and over again, and we can't like pop that bubble where everyone's like, oh, this is the conversation everyone is having at the same time.
Right, exactly. Well, what's funny about that is you just very succinctly expressed what I wanted to say to Eric when he was talking about his experience in the tank, when it dropped into this other space. And he's like, I've never had anything do that to me like that before. I'm misquoting him. But basically what he was talking about is the way that he got there, not necessarily that space. But the way that you got there, because that's the part that we can identify.
Right.
You know, I used to say about psychedelics, I used to call a certain thing MSD-23. And MSD-23 was when you did enough of anything, you would end up there. Like, it didn't matter if it was, you know, DMT, LSD.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm really curious now, as you've left your crazy San Francisco context, and you've moved to New York State, and you're working with kids, and you're teaching. How does this sort of, you know, decades of wild and woolly experience sort of pan out in your daily life? Because you've been doing this stuff for a long time, you know, and doing it with a lot of courage and wackiness and intelligence.
And complete insanity.
What does the life look like after that, after years of that?
All right. So this hopefully will be up by Monday. If you bop onto the website, there should be a placeholder that will let you sign up for the RSS feed. But my goal is I really want to work on working on something called permastoned. And permastoned, I'm calling chemical intrusions on the real. But it was a very curious experience. I had a 20-something California medical marijuana user who I met when he was like 24. And now he's in his early 30s. And he's married, and his life is completely radically changed. But he would insist that I get stoned with him, like every time we got together. And we were chatting one day via Gmail or GChat or something like that. And he's like, yeah, I can't smoke marijuana anymore unless I'm doing it just with my wife, because suddenly I start hearing like four levels of the conversation simultaneously. And I went, aha, I told you, welcome to permastoned. And, you know, there's this myth always in the drug culture that you take these drugs and you reach this point of enlightenment. And we know it's a myth. We know that this is just this is nonsense part of the narrative. But actually, I don't think it's complete nonsense part of the narrative. I think I'm not the only one, but I think there's a lot of people who have achieved this state where we're just permanently altered. now,
I think I was born that way.
Well, no, I was too, but I have delusions. The difference between me and, for example, my partner is that my partner will be like, how could you have not noticed that? And I'll be like so thrilled that I didn't notice it, because you see, I now see things that most people just blank out.
Right.
Like, everybody has their blind spots. Everybody wanders around in a fog. Everybody has their crutches and the things that they're sort of walking around in. The only difference is, for those who have achieved permastone, we constantly know that. It's not a question. It's this constant state. And the world is a weird thing. I mean, out here in Binghamton, New York, and Binghamton is a beautiful small city. It's actually the founding place of IBM and was the number two, during the Cold War, the number two A-bomb hitting site by the Russians, because IBM was here and Boeing was here and all this other stuff. But it is much more of a typical what's happening to America with the economy and everything down than I've been in a very long time. And it's weird. All this stuff still happens around me, and people are just like, how the hell can you live in this life? When I first showed up here, my girlfriend, my partner Tracy, took me to one of her favorite parks to hike, and we're out in the middle of the woods, and suddenly this guy comes running through the woods, stops, and we immediately begin chatting about his experience with the creation of the AIDS virus in Africa in the late 70s and why he had to get out of the special forces. And then we identified three people we knew in common. And I was out in the middle of the woods in Binghamton.
Incredible.
The network
it's just
keeps
weird.
Extended.
It's like I always thought it was San Francisco, but it's not. It's whatever this life is.
It's the curvature.
So when you're in the situation of teaching, you know, of whether or not that's, you know, people that you're lecturing to, or individuals mm-hmm. who come to you, or younger people who are looking for guidance, or older people who are looking for guidance. Yeah. What is it you're trying to communicate? Is it sort of trying to sort of induce people into a sort of way of being like there's a sort of world next door, whether it's the permastoned world or the world of multi-dimensions or the world of the long conversation? And is there anything really like to is there any knowledge to actually communicate, or is it almost more of a way of seeing that you kind of pick up simply by being around or by having conversation or almost in an elusive fashion? Do you understand what I'm trying to say? I mean, is there something to really communicate directly?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's the whole discussion. I mean, yes, a Zen priest knows what transmission is, but I don't. You know, I don't know, but I have a feeling I know. I think I know what a transmission is in the Zen lineage. But it's not something that you can say or do or pass on the cloak and robe, right? It definitely is this way of seeing the world. And here's the other thing. I have one student who's in his mid-20s, fantastic guy, very strong Ogun. And he asked me if he could work with me, and I said, sure. And I said, you know, you have to ask me three times, and it can't be just like day after day. You have to like give a week between. And he did, and so we start working together. And a lot of it is just, he came up one day, like, I was like, why were you so interested in working with me? And he's like, well, because here you are, 50, and you're still walking and talking. And, like, dude, you got to be doing something right, because that's the way my life is, and I can't see myself making it for more than a few more years. And I'm like, So half, I think, of whatever happens during the CERT teaching is basic, practical, sensible things. You know, there's a old Jewish mysticism story about the rabbi who gets an apprentice, and his apprentice is like, you have to teach me everything you know. And so he says, sure, you sleep under my bed. And so every night he would see him take off his pants, put down his shoes. When he made love to his wife, he was underneath the bed and all of that. And after 5 years, he's like, okay, I'm ready to learn. And he's like, you've learned everything I know. You now know how to take off your shoes. You know how to make love. That's all that's important in this world.
No, it's really funny because, I mean, I've spent so much of my life, you know, working with ideas, trying to communicate ideas, trying to sort of clarify, bring forward. I analyze in my writing and in my speaking, but I increasingly feel that in a way is just a kind of setting for something else that I can't really name. That's kind of what I talked about at the beginning, where it's more and more. It's not what I know or what knowledge I have access to or what filter of concepts or techniques or ideas. It's actually something relational with people, but also sort of with energies or places that's much more intangible. And it's not separate from the concrete knowledge that's transmitted or ways of thinking or concrete practices, but it's sort of alongside it in a way. I guess poetry is a good example of how it manifests in language, more than expository prose.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that, like, if anybody starts working with me, I'll end up saying this to them, like, dozens of times, if not hundreds of times, which is just this: note it and move on. And this reflects back to also what you said in the beginning about the poetry, that it's dangerous to live there. And after a while, when life gets weird enough, you don't just turn pro, you just start getting to the point that you just are like, oh, that's interesting. And then you just keep on keeping on with whatever else is going on and important in your life. You don't get caught up in some anomalous phenomenon or some, weird thought or whatever. You just keep moving forward and doing the work. And that way you stay safe, because otherwise you can get sucked right in. And that's how a lot of people have lost themselves.
Yeah, and I feel that. Yeah, you get lost, but also that whole strategy that you're talking about is not just applicable to, fringe walkers like us who really are interested in kind of cultivating weird experiences and seeing how far you can go and all these strange ideas. That's basically just the way the world is. That's the world that we're being introduced with, all of these, apps and multiple dimensions of cultural conversations, and this is intense media space and the threat of economic break, this whole crazy thing that we're in now. That's just a generalized condition, just coming around again to, like, that feels like that there are these traditions, these ways, these modes of being in relationship to this material that are in the kind of freak weirdo tradition that we come from, that have a lot of place right now. But it's hard to see where to exactly hook them on to a lot of the conversations going on in consciousness hacking and elsewhere today. But
I mean, look at things like Snowpiercer or even True Detectives or any of those. I mean, Snowpiercer was like possibly the greatest Gnostic movie ever made, and it exists out there as a sort of like cultural phenomenon. I think there's basically autodidactics and everybody else at this point. Like, I have me.
That's a great way to say it. You know what, though? We got to wrap it up. Okay. This has been wonderful. I knew it would be like this. It would go all over the place, and I hope it's meaningful to some of the to listeners. But I've totally enjoyed talking to you today, Yuris.
Enjoyed talking to you guys.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. What's the name of the website again?
Oh, permastoned.org.
Okay, we'll look for it next week.
All right, cool. All right, thanks, guys.
All right, well, great. From me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.